सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। दिस पॉडकास्ट टेक्स अप डेवलपमेंट इश्यूज एंड स्पेशली डेवलपमेंट इश्यूज रिलेटेड टू पाकिस्तान। One topic that we've touched tangentially but never really picked up is the role of technology and innovation in Pakistan. And I think this is a very, very important topic. In fact, maybe the core of development. So I'm very happy to say that today I have got a leading exponent in this area, Mr. Yusuf Hussain, who is a very well-known personality now in Pakistan. He has done his own startups and has been contributing to the technology world around the world. But he's now come back to Pakistan to contribute to Pakistan. He is now heading up this effort called Ignite, which is a fund for technology development made out of mobile CESs. Mr. Hussain has done sterling work by setting up an incubation system in Pakistan. So let's talk to him about that. Welcome, Yusuf.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yusuf Saab, can we begin by just briefly you telling people, I've given your background a little bit, but maybe you want to add some details. Can you tell a little bit about yourself, what you've been doing, etc.? Just briefly, then we'll dive deep into the subject of innovation technology.
Okay. I am from the private sector, like you mentioned. I've done startups. I've spent a little under 2 decades in the USA. I did a startup there which was pretty successful. On my return, it seems once about every 10 years or so, I joined the government for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. So 10 years ago, I was heading Pakistan's Software Export Board, and right now I'm with the Ignite National Technology Fund. Mm-hmm. And in between, I was doing startups. I was doing what is called an incubator, where you kind of mentor and grow startups. Mm-hmm. And I was also a senior IT advisor with the World Bank for a couple of years in there. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So you've got an excellent background. Now, very briefly, perhaps we can begin here. What do you mean by technology? Very simple question, but I think it's very confusing. So let's get it straight.
Well, by technology, I mean the physical manifestation of a algorithm. So a technology in terms of it may be manifested in the machine. It may be manifested in terms of human knowledge or in terms of written processes, mm-hmm. which can then be employed to provide some kind of a function in society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, what do you mean by innovation?
Okay, innovation, I would say, is, ahead in society, but the definition would be that innovation is an idea or an invention which gets transformed into a product or service which impacts society. So it's not enough to be an invention which does not have wide impact. Mm-hmm.
But then you could also be an innovator in the sense, for example, I often think about it and I talk about it, that people think that innovation is something very big and it's related to technology, that innovation is Microsoft and Google, that innovation is, some big thing that we have done in terms of setting up an algorithm or doing something in terms of dealing with computers and advances in society. But the way I look at it is Starbucks an innovation or not?
I would say definitely. Starbucks is an innovation.
Right.
Innovation can be of different scales. You can have incremental innovation, mm-hmm. making those little changes and improvements, whether in your process or your organizational model or in terms of some technology. So, for example, throughout history, from the invention of fire to the wheel, to the East India Company, mm-hmm. which was an organizational innovation, these are all innovations.
No, absolutely correct. I think that's a very important point to make, that innovation is any improvement or any new way of doing things. But then tell me, are both technology and innovation underpinned by human creativity?
Absolutely. I would definitely say that it is. I mean, let us say coming up with a scientific theorem or coming up with a new book or a great piece of music maybe more creative, and innovation from that perspective on the scale of creativity may be less so. But yes, it does spring from creativity because you're looking at your existing environment and you're coming up with a new process or a new technology which changes things and which improves things. So there is a creative aspect to that.
So, Yusuf Sahib, then now we've got three very important concepts tied together, which is creativity, innovation, and technology. And technology, as you said, is something that that develops processes or products or services that, in a sense, help humanity move forward. And innovation is a process of doing it, and all this is underpinned by creativity. Can you tell me, now that you've been associated with Pakistan for a long time and you know Pakistan very well from many different directions, you've seen Pakistan through international lens and local lens, how do you rate these three things in Pakistan, innovation, creativity, and technology?
Well, in terms of impact on society, extremely low. I've not visited, let's say, Bangladesh recently. I have visited Afghanistan recently. We are ahead of Afghanistan. But just to give you an example, in 2013, 2014, Afghanistan was ahead of us in mobile broadband, which is 3G, 4G access through your smartphone, which is an example of innovation. So I would say that in international ratings, innovation ratings, creativity ratings, we rank in the bottom quartile of nations. And some others in our neighborhood, even some in sub-Saharan Africa, are ahead of us.
And why do you say that is so?
Well, I feel that when I look at Pakistani people, it's almost become a cliche, but it's a correct cliche. They are very smart and they are very enterprising. They have performed the world over. So that's a given, whether it is O levels or A levels or whether it is Microsoft certification ages or whatever, they lead the world. So clearly, that kind of individual brilliance, enterprise, hard work has not translated into a social contract which collectively brings that out as a society or as a nation.
And but then what is lacking? What should be done to bring out? I mean, you're absolutely right. Look, think about it. Every nation is imbued with talent. As you know, the bell curve operates everywhere and there are creative people everywhere. As I keep saying to people that there must be at least a few thousand Wimbledon champions and Nobel Prize winners somewhere in Pakistan, but they are diamonds in the rough. They have not been hewed and sculpted to perform the way they should. So in some sense, creativity we can take as given that there are maybe a few thousand Nobel Prize winners in Pakistan. It is our fault we haven't brought them out. So where is the fault?
Well, I think the fault is in, if I were to put it in one word, inclusivity. In terms of the basic drivers that you need to be able to think. I mean, for example, malnutrition alone, physical and mental stunting alone, takes away, let's say, about 40% of our population. Then we've got out-of-school children who then may be capable of doing some kind of what we call jugaad, or kind of a workaround, but in terms of innovation or wider societal impact or creative scale, they're not able to do that. Then even when we come to in-school children, we've got a very small minority which has been equipped with the analytical thinking or which has been equipped with the opportunity to be creative and curious, to be able to go on in life and have attained some significant innovation. Because if we look around the world, the difference between technology and innovation is that one of the differences is that technology comes out of scientific knowledge. Innovation may come out of scientific knowledge or it may not. In fact, some people like Nassim Nicholas Taleb argues that most innovation does not come from science, it comes from tinkering, like the Wright brothers. But even for that kind of tinkering, even for that kind of a technician approach, you need some basic level of education and help and some clustering, some networking, which is not available to 90% plus of our population.
Now, is this due to the fact that the government doesn't make the right policy, or is it in our culture, or somewhere embedded in our societal values? I mean, what is the? Can you identify some causes or some?
Yeah, well, I think the root cause is cultural. The root cause is that we are largely a feudal society. We are trying to break that mindset. But a feudal society, or even a state-oriented society, which is the first stage of industrialization, is a society based on extraction and a society based on me versus you rather than a win-win attitude. And those cultural traits and that level of development in our society is manifested in our governance. And that governance, too, is extractive or ostentatious, or we could say corrupt.
Okay. Now, fine. But now you have taken on a challenge in terms of trying to set up an innovative spark in Pakistan. So tell us, what is it that you're doing with Ignite, and how are you seeking to operate in a milieu where the culture is against you, the governance is against you? So what is your modus operandi, and how do you think you'll make the change?
Okay. Well, first of all, even in overall society which lacks innovation or which lacks inclusivity, there are many islands of excellence in Pakistan. Be they in a state institution like the motorway police or the army, or be that in a corporation like Telenor or Engro, or some of the schools there. So there are islands, and similarly when we talk about Ignite is, like you mentioned, government owned but funded by telecom operators and internet service providers, and our board is public private. So when you see, my background is in startups and in incubators and in the funding of startups. And by the way, it is startups which have gone on now to become the biggest corporations in the world, Apple, Google, and so on, and also the equivalents in China and India. So I had that background, and then I think I happened to be at the right place at the right time, because in the last government, we had a minister, Anusha Raman, who was very focused, among other things. She was also focused on building out incubators and on mass-scale digital training. So with her, then in the ministry, we had a supportive secretary as well as members. So that value chain started from there. I was here. When I came in, I saw there were a lot of, or at least a bunch of smart, sharp people. I think to make a difference, but they were kind of underutilized, lying in different departments at lower level. So, one of the things I've developed over the years in the U.S. and in Pakistan is I have a nose for people. I kind of get a sense for their strengths and weaknesses, and I have kind of a sense of where to place them kind of who can do what and who basically I need to fire. So I did a bit of that, and as a result of that, our National Incubation Center kind of rolled out at kind of a record pace. In about 1 year, 6 months, we were able to operationalize five of them. People used to say, even in the country at IBM, that it would take 6 or 7 years based on past experience. But because I think the right people in the right place, there was a support from the minister, from the ministry, from the board. We were able to get some excellent partners. We threw a wide net across the country. We did PEPRA compliant bidding. We had over 100 leading companies, business groups, media companies, telcos apply, banks, and so on. And we awarded it. And then they took over. We monitored them. We fund them. And that's how we progressed.
Great. So your system now is that you have a fund, and you have incubation centers, and you call for competitive projects, and then you incubate them, and you're hoping to create Pakistan's Google or Apple or whatever. Is that a correct description of your model?
Excellent description. That's it. Basically, if I can just add one thing, obviously we've had these great startups come out of other countries. Every country, almost from USA to Israel, to China, to India, they are setting up these incubators to clone great startups. And that's what we seek to do there.
But think about it. I mean, in a sense, we'd call these startups, but I remember reading about Detroit around the turn of the 20th century. And Detroit was startup city then. There were about 100 car manufacturing companies setting up there. And eventually Chrysler, GM, and Ford emerged, and they were the winners in that setup. And for a long period of time, for about a century, they really were the largest employers and they really were the largest companies in the U.S. Now, unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, now as the world progresses, things happen, and now General Motors is very small compared to IT companies. So in that sense, startup culture has been a part of the U.S. for a long period of time. In fact, from the very beginning, I would say, I remember Alexis de Tocqueville writing about it a long time ago, that U.S. is a country that has a startup culture. We don't have a startup culture, do we? So if we don't have a startup culture, how well do you think that will work out? Your incubation method will work out here?
Well, first of all, I don't know. I mean, you know better if Alexis de Tocqueville used the word startup. But certainly, there was what we call an entrepreneurial culture in the United States.
That's right. He didn't use startup, he used entrepreneurial, yeah.
Right.
He didn't even use entrepreneurial. He basically described the
adventurous culture, maybe.
That he described the culture that this was a self-help culture. This is a creative culture, that people were willing to do things here for themselves rather than look to the government for a solution.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So in other words, we can say that the United States had a and still may veer back toward a libertarian culture, right? A culture with a low government footprint and people going out and setting up homesteads on farms and just being as independent as possible. So we had that, and then you're absolutely right. I mean, what is a startup but a new business? And whenever there's churn, whether it was the railways or it was the oil companies or it was Henry Ford or it was John D. Rockefeller, those were entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are new businessmen, basically.
Yeah.
So those great industries were created by these adventurous businessmen. Now, but the point is that, keeping the United States for the time being and then coming to Pakistan, that level, that pace of innovation has sped up. And now it is much more rampant. But it is not just about an entrepreneur in the sense of running your own homestead, your own small and medium enterprise. It's about creating large corporations like a Ford, like a Standard Oil. But now there are many more of those, right? So it is spreading. The California germ, call it, came out of California, spread all over the United States. Now, if you look at Pakistan, number one, in Pakistan also, the nation state, the grasp of the state on the country is relatively recent. Now, what we had before was more of a feudal culture. But even in that feudal culture, if we read, for example, Shashi Tharoor recently, or we read Will Durant, his book on India, we see that even when the British came in 1750, there was a shipbuilding industry here, there was textiles, there was mining, there were gems, we had great architecture. I was visiting the Institute of Space Technology here on the outskirts of Islamabad, and they had astrolabes, which were, Lahore was one of the leading makers of astrolabes in the world. We had rocketry from Tipu Sultan, which he used in his campaigns. So we had that kind of innovation, but obviously, the wave of innovation, the wave of science which came out of Europe subsumed that. And that was really a tidal wave, and it subsumed these little innovations here and there. But what we see is that I view it in Pakistan as a social re-engineering experiment. Just like the United States itself was a social re-engineering experiment where they wanted to get away from the tribal wars of Europe and create a culture where there was not a monarch and there was this libertarianism. Or let's say even Stalin or Lenin experimented with communism or Mao. Similarly, we, in my mind, in our own very, very small way, through our incubators, as are other incubators in Pakistan, doing a social engineering, which starts with saying, that when you step into these distinctive architectures, and we have some very distinctive architectures, you step in from a world of a society outside, which is cynical sometimes, which is despondent sometimes, which is complaining sometimes, and you step in here with a celebration of imagination and possibilities and perseverance, and here you've got to solve problems. So that is one of the kind of fundamental things we do, and we've had, that's what we're doing, and we've had some success with that.
Mm-hmm. Look, you're absolutely right. No culture is without innovation, creativity, entrepreneurship. The question really is whether those take root or not. Our people also have entrepreneurship, but the way I look at it is that our people show their entrepreneurship by migrating. They leave this country because it does not give them the opportunity to express themselves, be creative, etc. And when they go to the US, for example, you see lots of people are doing very well, whether it's in technology or even in terms of, running businesses or 7-Elevens or franchises. I mean, I see lots of creative people here who are doing very well. Unfortunately, our country does not give space. When you think about another related question that I'd like to explore with you, the state of entrepreneurship in Pakistan. I did a paper on this long time ago, about 10 years ago. And I remember I was deeply disappointed that Pakistan, well, again, let me qualify that. Yes, at the lower level, there is entrepreneurship. But at the upper level, as far as industry goes, as far as big business goes, there's no entrepreneurship. Because most of them are basically living on government licenses or government subsidies. At the lower level, there is entrepreneurship. Somebody will set up something or do something. As I said, migrate. But there's no way they can grow or mainstream it. Would you agree with that, or would you think that's different?
No, I would absolutely agree with that. Mm-hmm. I remember reading your paper, mm-hmm, when you were Deputy Chairman of the Planning Commission. I think it was Pakistan's Place in the Future, mm-hmm, or some such title. Mm-hmm. And I think you very starkly pointed out that how we need to, that basically our growth is basically due to our population increase. We are in a rent-seeking culture. The big businesses, the factories are in a rent-seeking mode. It's crony capitalism. And we got to transition toward a more competitive and a more innovative corporate structure at the higher level. And without that kind of innovation and that kind of competitiveness, we'll get stuck where we are today, where we cannot really produce high value add quality produce at a price level the world will buy, and we are forced to import a lot of these high value add, not only goods but also services, where a Turkey or a China builds our roadways, and therefore we are kind of at the bottom of the pyramid. So I would 100% agree with you.
Yusuf Sahib, now in your incubation, I mean, the one thing that has really helped us, I think, we go back to our earlier discussion on technology, innovation, and entrepreneurship. What handicapped us at the beginning of our country in 1947 or later, was the fact that we had to all produce, go through what was, Rostow's sort of stages of growth, that we should first go agriculture, then industry, and then on to other things. So we are trying to build agriculture, then you're trying to build industry. But now I think technology has kind of liberated us. We can cross all stages. We can have our own Google. We don't have to go through agriculture and the stages of growth. So in that sense, what you're doing is vital. Will we be able to create high value-added companies? In some sense, we have. As you, I don't know whether you had hand in it or not, but I believe that Park Wheels and Daraz.pk did sell for a very good amount, and Alibaba has taken them over. But will we be able to create an Alibaba?
I think that, we determine our future. Okay. I think certainly we should be able to create an Alibaba. Mm-hmm. We did create an Easy Paisa, mm-hmm, which is a $400 million company, mm-hmm, and probably worth about twice as much, I'm guessing, mm-hmm, at least twice as much as Daraz when it was taken over by Alibaba. Mm-hmm. So absolutely we should. Mm-hmm. And what you so rightfully said, that technology can help us bypass technology and innovation. I mean, where we're saying technology is manifestation of science, while innovation and Alibaba or let's say whatever, Easy Paisa is not really that much of a manifestation of high science. It's just some more business savviness and some artificial intelligence and scalability put in there. So if that realization, now you see, I was reading a statement by the chief president of the Lahore Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and that 3 days ago, and that gentleman was saying that today to get economic growth, you have to be innovative. Mm-hmm. So he gets it. Mm-hmm. If our government gets it, even some people, I would say in the tech industry don't get this, by the way, because many people in the tech industry are just kind of focused on or blinded on IT services growth, IT services growth. But what you're talking about is something different. What you're talking about is technology and innovation to solve the most meaningful problems of Pakistan, right? Whether that is water depletion, whether that is energy, whether that is nutrition, all these opportunities here, digitization. And so if that realization develops, absolutely we can do it. If Israel can do it with 15 million people and become one of the top startup nations in the world with several 15, 17 billion dollar people, with just 15 million people, certainly we can do it, yes.
But Yusuf Saab, I remember reading this book, you must have read it too, called Startup Nation on Israel. But don't forget that Israel has the largest per capita PhDs in the world. Their army has PhDs in there. Israel has the largest sort of, I think, or at least one of the largest research budgets in the world. And Israel lays a huge amount of priority on research and innovation. Unfortunately, we are nowhere near doing that. So in that sense, how will you find that, how will we catch up? I mean, what can we do to become Israel?
Okay, excellent question. So what can we do to become Israel? Now, first of all, absolutely, Israel, Israel, number one, got
I hope we don't get into trouble discussing this, by the way.
I know people in the army who read Startup Nation, and they are trying to incorporate that, because remember, in Startup Nation, one of the biggest sources of their top entrepreneurs is a unit of the army itself, which hires the best people, gives them a lot of responsibility at a young age, and a lot of the top CEOs come out of that army.
Joseph
unit.
Sam, by the way, there's also this woman Mazakuto has documented that even in the U.S., the army is one of the biggest sources of innovation. DARPA has been behind most of the innovation in the US. So that's a given in almost all societies, right? And even in history, the army was one of the reasons that we innovated, was because the army needed new weapons all the time and people innovated.
Very true, but with one big difference. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, in the United States, the whole Silicon Valley, the whole Silicon Valley has been birthed, has been funded by defense, by NASA, by DOD, by ARPA, by DARPA. Mm-hmm. Whether it is the internet, whether it is the computer chip, it's all come out of defense, right? But the difference, when I quote that example from Startup Nation, is that what is the difference? The difference is that in Silicon Valley, it took Bill Hewitt and David Packard to put that together and create the first computer, or it took Shockley and it took Bill Noyes to create Fairchild Semiconductor and take that, or it took Steve Jobs to create the iPhone from a bunch of, and in fact, I should add the name of Ashir Aziz, who went through DARPA archives to come up with this algorithm for FireEye, which is a $5 billion company today. So the entrepreneurs who pulled together all this research were from the private sector. Now, the difference between Israel is that the entrepreneur is coming out of this army unit. I don't know if it's 6,900 or whatever. So that's the key difference, right? That's important. So, but coming back to Pakistan. Sorry, one second more in Israel. Now, in Israel, they set up 18 incubators, which failed, and they had to shut them down. Then they came up with another program called Yozma, where they brought in Silicon Valley venture capitalists with local Israelis, and they started doing that. They were able to outsource work from Intel and so on, develop R&D, and they put this ecosystem together. Now, in our society, we need to be innovative and creative, if I can use those words, in coming up with our own system that works. Now the other day I was actually brainstorming with Dr. Atar Rahman in HEG Institute of Chemistry, talking about just this, and we discussed certain ideas. Actually, I presented him with some, and he was kind enough to. And we are meeting again next this coming.
Okay.
That idea was that, I mean, how can we, number one, start with where do we focus on? How do we select where we focus? For a country with limited resources, focus is essential. Other than IT services export, that's all fine. What are the other things? What things in agriculture? Is it big data? Do we do nanotech for fertilizer? What are those four or five things where using, let's say, a simple thing like a Boston Consultancy Group matrix, we say, where do we have high capacity, low capacity, high opportunity, low opportunity? Which is a magic quadrant? Given, and the World Economic Forum publishes that for the next 0 to 5 years, 5 to 10 years, 10 plus years, what technologies do we expect to become commercial in which sectors, like automotive, like textiles, like food and beverages? Now, obviously, some of this is a line in the sand. I mean, a lot, you know, it's not cast in stone, but it provides a framework for what is going to be commercial, using which, and using our own inventory, we can set some courses, some focus areas where we hope to be at a world-class level, and then line up the incentive policy, line up the R&D, and line up the human workforce development, the PhDs, the patents to do that. So that's the kind of thinking that China does. This is the kind of thinking which has made China a backwater of low-end manufacturing into what it is today, where it sells more industrial robots than European Union or USA combined, right? Now they've said we are going to become the number one artificial intelligence country in the world by 2030. So that is what we're going to do. Which are our focus areas? How do we select them? What's the algorithm? Given that selection, what are the 6 or 7 implementation areas that we go after? How do we monitor execution? And how do we adjust course?
But Yusuf Sam, who's going to do that?
I think it should be a revamped planning commission. I think, which I'm going to call the Tabdili Commission.
What commission?
The Tabdili
Commission. Okay. Good word. Good name. Yeah.
The term du jour.
Good point. Good point. Yeah.
So the Tabdili Commission becomes a think tank that I know you have been advocating. A think tank with technologists, with economists, with private sector people, with people, like yourself, with people like Dr. Atar Rahman, with people like Razak Dawood, I know he's a minister now, but those kind of people who go through this with the help of analysts, that what is these four areas out of 20 where we can be a world player, and what are the things we're going to do, and how are we going to monitor them? Thankfully, we have the technology. And by the way, we are doing this in one of our own initiatives at Ignite, which is called DigiSkills.pk, whose mission is to deliver 1 million trainings by 2020. And we are wrapping it up, but already we are delivering about 30,000 as of August 1st. We've got a whole big data AI analytics at real time, looking at who's logged on, who's dropping off, why are they dropping off, what did they like, what did they not like, where did they earn money, based on which we keep iterating and improving. So the technology is there today to cut across all these different sectors of incentives and R&D and human workforce development and vocational training and infrastructure and patents and other intermediate outputs to see what's happening, what's not happening, and kind of keep learning and iterating quickly.
No, I think that's very valid and a very interesting thing, and I think you're doing absolutely the right thing. Now, tell me, let me go in this direction first, then I'll come there. What you said is absolutely right, and I take your point, and I think the Tabdili Commission should be made, and it's a very good idea. I used to say we should make a Ministry of Reform, but you're absolutely right, Tabdili is a better word, so let's do that. But the problem, Yusuf Saab, that I see is that, you know, you and I can, or whoever, can talk a lot. Unfortunately, there has to be people who have to receive the idea too. Now, let's go back a little bit in history. And my reading of the Industrial Revolution, and there's a lovely book on this. If you haven't read it, look at it. It's called The Republic of Letters by a famous economic historian called Joel Mocher. He's in Northwestern. And he talks about how the reason the Industrial Revolution happened is, oh, you know, I mean, it's one of the reasons, I shouldn't say the only reason. He said one very important reason was that the intellectuals, and this is what I use in my book too, that's where I kind of picked it up from. I didn't mention it, but I use that. That the intellectuals of Europe were very well networked together. They were, yes, a republic of letters. They were constantly talking to each other. They were building on each other. Galileo would write to, you know, so-and-so, Copernicus or so-and-so. I mean, I'm just kind of drawing on, maybe it's historically inaccurate, but he studied these letters. There are millions of, well, thousands of letters that these guys wrote. Some of them even wrote individually 1,000 letters to other scientists. And that was the first kind of internet that was working through letters, because they were exchanging ideas and developing new ideas. At the same time, there was a kind of a tinkering network too, where the artisans across Europe were learning from each other through guilds and various things. And it was a combination of these two networks where knowledge kind of went through the networks to develop new ideas. So Galileo, for example, you know, discovered the telescope or whatever, but other people made commercial use of the telescope. Or Newton discovered gravity, but then other people learned how, or the forces of, or the three laws of motion, other people learned how to use those laws of motion and tinker with them to make the steam engine and various things. Now, that network, I'm afraid, unfortunately, in Pakistan is missing, because I don't find intellectuals ready and capable of talking to each other. We tend to be still very individualistic, very isolated, very egocentric, and we don't like debates and discussions. The 19th century, the Renaissance was full of polemics, full of debates between various people, the key thinkers. And out of that came the Constitution and other innovative institutional changes that led to the development and growth of the Western world. Now, we are missing two things here. A, we are missing the network of intellectuals, the argument, the polemics, right? And B, we are missing the environment of listening to each other, to listening to these people. For example, don't forget, Newton was knighted in his time. He was 29 or something when he was knighted, and he was made the keeper of the mint. But here, we don't even recognize Salam or any one of our key thinkers. We want to, in a sense, keep the thinkers out. Our standard refrain in government that I kept hearing is that we don't need to innovate, we just need to follow. As I said, we want to follow best practice, we don't want to be innovative. So how do we get over that? I mean, if the culture is that of non-networked intellectuals, egocentric, individualistic, and on the other side, there's no society to receive them, can we really cross the hurdle that you're talking about?
Okay, so two things. Mm-hmm. First of all, mm-hmm, I completely concur with you, mm-hmm, that we need a clash of ideas. Mm-hmm. We need a clash of ideas, mm-hmm, to innovate. Mm-hmm. Now, in our incubators, we are trying to create that very culture. So when I talked about the new culture, mm-hmm, one thing was negativity versus positivity, mm-hmm, of problem solving versus complaining. Mm-hmm. And the other aspect of this culture is, mm-hmm, that is this clash of ideas, where we got to check our egos at the door, mm-hmm, and with respect, and we got to be able to poke holes in each other, mm-hmm, and we got to have wars. Mm-hmm. We even have wars, and I quote anecdotes. I quote anecdotes from, mm-hmm, Bill Gates and Paul Allen at, yeah, Microsoft, mm-hmm, where they used to shout at each other and stand on desks and shout at each other and come. And so we are creating that culture, mm-hmm, number one. Mm-hmm. In our own WhatsApp groups, in our company, on DigiSeals, for example, we say this again and again, mm-hmm, that if you agree, it doesn't matter much. Mm-hmm. But if you can disagree with reason, mm-hmm, you are our champ. Yeah. So we are doing this culture. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. Now, the second thing that you mentioned, again, very important, is this network. Now, I have a kind of a specific idea on that, which I have been socializing since a couple of months with STEDEC, Science and Technology Development Corporation, which is supposed to commercialize the work of PCSIR and other R&D institutes. And I bounced it off of Dr. Atha Rahman as well, and he really liked it. And what is this? This is an innovation information network. So here's what I'm saying. I'm saying that every R&D project going on, they have to report into this database or they will not get funded by the Planning Commission or whatever, number one. So this information keeps live. Mm. What they are doing in simple language that a layman can understand, that's very important. Mm-hmm. What is the impact in simple, I'm talking about technology mainly, but mm-hmm. in simple, that's one thing. And number two, all industrialist startups have access to this database. Search, and in fact, a similar database in the United States is using artificial intelligence mm-hmm. to find similar kind of research which may complement each other, or industrialists or investors or startups, they're using AI to do this. Because you know what AI is? AI is like your smarter cousin. In a way, mm-hmm. a guy is better than you in every way. At least in terms of a particular task. Mm-hmm. So this network, mm-hmm. just like, for example, I gave you the example of Usher Aziz.
Yeah.
He went through the DARPA archives to come up with the algorithm for FireEye.
Yeah.
Similarly, all our investors, industrial startups, come across this research of not only scientific research, but tinkering and other kind of technology. Mm-hmm. And they can then network online in a, at a much quicker level than Newton could do in his day and age, and with a much bigger networking effect that Newton could ever hope to achieve or Galileo their age.
Hmm. But ultimately, at the recipient end, there is a human being. And right. we have to engage, and we have to learn to engage. And the key thing that you mentioned, I think, which is also very important, you should talk about it, the role of failure. Because we yes. have a very poor attitude towards failure.
Yes.
How can we improve our attitude? And first of all, what do you think of failure, and how can we improve our attitude towards it?
Well, whenever, you know, it's like this. A startup founder, mm-hmm. Distinct from an SME. An SME is another restaurant or mm-hmm. software development house or digital or gym. Mm-hmm. A startup is innovative. Let's do something new. So Starbucks or McDonald's are startups, and mm-hmm. but Chai Khana is just another restaurant. Mm-hmm. So when you're doing something innovative, the risk comes with it. It's like in the old days, people decide to live in their village, but some people say, we are going to discover the world, we're going to discover new lands. That is the startup entrepreneur of today. Hmm. Now, when you do that, that comes with risk. And enough, that means you're not risky enough. You're not taking enough of a risk. You are too conservative. So failure comes with innovation and it comes with startups. It is a must. We must embrace failure. We must learn from failure. In the United States, I always promote, and I love Pakistan, even when I was in the U.S. particularly. But just this is a joke amongst us, but we used to say, let's say third world failure is a failure of doing something underhanded.
Right.
While an American failure is a positive thing because you come back, you learn so much, you gain so much that you're going to get even more investment now, or you're going to get even promotion now because you suffered cuts and bruises and you've learned. That is what positive failure is about. And I was very happy to see that in Telenor, Irfan Wahab, the CEO, did a failure day where everybody, including me and him, came on and said, this is where I failed.
Good.
This is what I learned. This is why I'm so proud. And that's what you guys got to do.
Excellent. But you know, you said something about a restaurant, but let me also quote to you that restaurants can also be very innovative. For example, I regret I sold Chipotle Mexican Grill. Chipotle is now standing at 510 and
yeah.
has a market cap of $14 billion, right?
Correct.
Now, Correct. This is a restaurant chain that just started, like, I think, 5-10 years ago, not very old.
Yes,
but
yes.
If we can build even Chipotle type businesses, we will be yeah. a high income country, right?
Correct. I mean, correct.
The question really is, as far as I can see, innovation knows no bounds. Even a company like Chipotle yeah. can make it. Another company that yes. comes to my mind, for example, which is very interesting, is WeWork, right?
Yes.
I personally went and spent a few days in WeWork just to find out what it's like. And I tell you, it's marvelous. You know, I mean, young people are getting together, they're discussing innovative ideas, and partly your incubators are like WeWork, right? You get these, mm-hmm. give these young people spaces to come and, you know, discuss and
yes.
be innovative. Now that WeWork yes. thing has also grown, I mean, I think it's in 70 countries and it's worth mm-hmm. a few billion dollars. And again, I think it started
yes.
5 years ago or less or something like that, right? And now they've also
yes.
started something called WeLive. So the point I'm trying to make is, innovation can be everywhere. For example, when I was doing my entrepreneurship, one thing that I went to Sialkot and I asked those people. Now think about it. Sialkot has been in business for 100 years, I think, or more. They've been exporting sports goods for a long time, and they've been exporting surgical goods for a long time. And we are very proud of the fact that the World Cup football was used, it was made in Sialkot.
But yes.
My question to them was that, you know, after 100 years, the average Sialkot company is still not more than $100 million. I mean, the best, I would say, not the average. Average is even less. Average is $30, $40 million. So I said, guys, what have you achieved? Your grandfather started this business, and over 100 years, you're not yet a billion-dollar company, leave alone a Chipotle or a WeWork. Now, why is it that a company like Sialkot cannot climb? Because we just don't want to create company. We also want to create billion-dollar companies. So I keep telling my friends, the businessmen who keep saying to me, that, hey, you're against us. I keep saying, I want you to be billionaires. I'm for you. But I want you to be billionaires through innovation. Right now, you're sitting at $50 to $100 million through government licenses. And that's not getting us anywhere. But why can't we have billion-dollar companies in Pakistan?
No, I completely agree with you. Now, but let me clarify one thing. Mm. I was quoting Starbucks or McDonald's or Chipotle as examples of great innovation and as examples of great startups, right? Mm. I was distinguishing them from your mom and pop shop, from your mom and pop restaurant, which I would call an SME, right? I was doing this distinction.
How do we
distinguish SME, a me too, small and medium enterprise, from an innovative startup?
Right.
In my mind, this is something I've been thinking about. In my mind, the key distinction is abstraction. So an abstraction can be in a physical product. So let's say an iPhone can be used by a Chinese or a Pakistani or an American, old, young, semi-literate, literate, and draw benefit. Because it's not a separate iPhone for everybody. They've abstracted out the highest common denominator and they've manifested it in this highly usable product. Easy Paisa did this with its counters for money exchange, right? They abstracted it out that how could we set up a software and these counters where anybody could exchange money anywhere. McDonald's, you know, I like to give this example. Bundu Khan was a great restaurant in Karachi. I don't know if this is historically correct, but just as an example. Now, they opened a branch in Islamabad. The quality suffered in Karachi because the main guy came here. They opened up a branch in Ahmedabad, and the partners split up in Islamabad, and they went their separate ways. They couldn't sustain. Yet a McDonald's can run 30,000 restaurants around the world a burger is supplied in 4 minutes. How did they do that? They abstracted the SOPs, location, eyeballs, socioeconomic, how big, how wide the corridors, the supply chain for a bun, for a ketchup, mustard, lettuce, tomato, you know, meat. What is the supply chain? What is a quality check? Which is stored where? What is the refrigeration? Who do we hire? How long do we train? You know, they abstracted in a way that they could spread out.
Purple.
That is the secret of a Chipotle. That is the secret of this innovation, right? The second point I also agree with you on. We got to create billion-dollar companies. Now, we see that, you know, the biggest IT company is about $60 million. TRG, if you add that with its US-based company, is about $300 million. But we've got Tata, we've got Wipro and Infosys, which are now touching $20 billion. How are you going to compete with them? So how do you do that? Now, I think it's a combination of a couple of things. We see as an example what Japan did, why they called it Japan Inc., what China did. We see what South Korea did when it supported its heavy industry and then its electronics industry and before that chemicals. I mean, they came up with exactly what we discovered with the Tabdili Commission. They came up with a series of incentives, human resource development, with R&D, with international linkages and access, big corporations helping each other to come up with these large corporations. Because right now, we are starting, remember, from the beginning of our conversation with one starting assumption that there is a great deal of talent in this country, including in those Sialkot businessmen or these IT companies. Why have they not grown? It's a combination of, you know, whatever, 35 authorities to whom they have to pay taxes, about a kind of a cannibalistic taxation system, and it's about this lack of support from different organs of the government, which other in other countries like Korea and China and Japan, they have been getting.
But I think, no, I take your point, and I think that's a very good point. But Yusuf Saab, the problem is we all, I mean, every seminar I go to, they talk about China and Korea and how we should become China and Korea. What we forget is that I was just doing this study, but we talked about it too, on the research system in Pakistan. And for that, I went and reviewed a few research systems in the world. And China, for example, Yusuf Saab, has a goal that they're going to spend 2.5% of GDP on research, not education, on research, right?
Correct.
And China has 5 or 6, maybe it's more, 7 or 8 councils, like the Engineering Council, IT Council, Social Science Council, all kinds of councils, which are made of top professionals, which do competitive, just like you're doing incubators, they do for research around the country. And right. China also, all these councils report to the cabinet. They don't report to a secretary or whatever. They all report to the cabinet, right? So in a sense, what China is doing is, what Israel has done is create a thinking government. And I think this is what happened in Japan. This is what happened in Korea, because they've created thinking governments.
Yes.
We unfortunately resist that approach. We don't want to create a thinking government. So even if you have a Tablighi commission, if the whole government is not thinking, and I don't think it'll happen. In the recently, I wrote this in the paper that if the cabinet, for example, is not a thinking cabinet, then forget it. Nothing's going to happen.
Yes. Now,
I was in the government for 3 years as the deputy chairman of the planning commission, which is the highest, position that an economist can have. Finance minister, deputy chairman of state bank, those are the highest positions that economists can have. Yeah. But I kept telling the prime minister and the president, Mr. President, Mr. Prime Minister, I've never made a substantive presentation to you. We've never had a substantive discussion, right? The kind of discussion that you are having, we can't have that in the cabinet. That they ideally, they should call you to make a presentation in the cabinet, and the cabinet should spend a whole day discussing these things with you. Not 5 minutes. Yusuf Saab, great job. Thank you very much. Go home. That's no good. They must spend a whole day talking about it. Their secretaries, everybody should be talking about it for a month or so. You have to create a thinking government. I don't see us doing that at any time. So without that, do you think we can leapfrog? Because my biggest problem is, without a thinking government, I don't think we can leapfrog.
Short answer, I completely agree with you. I mean, if the prime minister and the cabinet are not giving you time, nothing can happen. Absolutely. So one is going forward on the assumption that that time will be given.
Yeah.
And one is going forward, trying to soften the ground to create that time, right? So hopefully this Monday, I submitted an article to a newspaper called the Tabdili Commission that we get published on this idea.
Wonderful.
The other article that I'm actually working on right now, I'm putting my thoughts together. I read through Dr. Ishat Hussain's 2008 report. It's about 550-page government reform. I know you had him last time, and I look forward to hearing that conversation you had with him as well. I read his book, and I've been kind of exchanging some views with him on a WhatsApp group. I couldn't meet him this trip in Karachi, unfortunately, and now, of course, he's in the government.
No, he's coming
back. I think he's the institutional reform and austerity.
Yeah.
So, also advisor. But in any case, The title of my article is quite similar to what you just said. The title of my article, I'm still working on, but the title is something like this. How a Learning Government Can Delight Citizens and Ease Business.
Yeah. Good point.
Okay, so I use the term learning government.
Very good point.
Now, in the learning government, I take some ideas from Ishat Hussain, his 500-page government reform report. I take some other ideas. I forget the title, but I'm reading this really excellent book on how the British digitized the government and the results and the pitfalls. So I'm taking some ideas from there, and then my own ideas, having worked in the government for 2 years before and now, and I'm putting them together in this recipe, how to create in a very implementation-oriented way, using this innovation information network, for example, using certain e-government things. How can you create this where there is where the government can do nothing but keep learning. Mm. Why? Because the lessons learned are going to be collected in any case, and they're going to be put up in a very readable dashboard to the Prime Minister and the ministers, where they'll be looking at your performance, and they'll be looking at your thing, and they'll be forced to become a learning government. Mm. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Wonderful. Yusuf Saab, this has been a fascinating conversation. I've really enjoyed it. But let me ask you one last question that I think should be very important for kids to hear. Your incubators that you're running, what are the success? I mean, give us some idea. What are the success factors and what are you looking at going forward? How do you predict your success factors and how many companies do you think will come out of this? And secondly, how should kids think about participating with you?
Okay, very good. Now, first of all, let me say that, I read your book, How Pakistan Became an Asian Tiger by 2050. Mm-hmm. Just a wonderful book. First of all, I remember your concept of networks, mm-hmm. which you referred to a bit earlier as well. Mm-hmm. And I remember your concept of community centers, city centers as mm-hmm. hubs of innovation, because they have a lot of diverse participation from whatever, engineers and artists and all sorts of people. Mm-hmm. Now, so going back to your concept of networks and community centers as hubs of cities, the incubation centers are fundamentally that, first of all. These are networking, collaboration, and exchange where just the basic social themes that you're talking about, the clash of ideas, the polemics against each other, the different diverse coming. First of all, it's that. So I would say that for all those youth out there who are looking to march to the beat of their own inner drummer, who are interested in going off the beaten path, who are not interested in a corporate job or whatever, and who want to explore themselves and their ideas, and there's a certain mindset and an adventurous spirit which requires that, they are the ones we are attracting. Come on now. And we will be providing not only WeWork-like co-working spaces, which you referred to earlier, the WeWork-like networking, clustering, co-working spaces. But in addition to that, we are providing some layers on top of that. What are those layers? Those layers are, for example, a curriculum which teaches you how to build great businesses, learning by doing. So let's say a great speaker, so let's say it's branding and marketing. We will get the VP marketing of Jazz, who will come in and deliver a talk. You will read up on it, and then you will go out and build that piece in your own business. So it's not in through one ear and out through another ear. It is actually learning by doing. This curriculum, on top of that, we'll have mentors from different vectors, from different verticals, like health or energy, guiding you, telling you about the industry structure, because that's kind of worth its weight in gold beyond just general business mentorship. We will have the provision of basic services for financial, legal, lawyer, so that you don't waste your time in those things. And then we will have coaching to help you focus and monitor. Because many a time these young businesses, they go off and go off in divergent directions. What is that one metric? What is that one metric you need to do this week, whether it is incorporate a company, build a product, increase your sales by 10%? How did you fare in that one focused endeavor? And what is your one problem? Be that you need to get a meeting or you need to develop a financial model. Did the incubation management team help you address that? So these are all the value adds. And insofar as outcome goes, outcome-wise, we are looking at how much revenue these companies have generated, how much investment they generated, because that's kind of a rite of passage. You need investment. How many employees? Tomorrow, if you look at Dawn, we are placing a report card on what we accomplished in 1 year, 6 months, not only in terms of operationalizing these five incubators, but in terms of the funding we've been able to raise from private sources, which is over 2 billion rupees, which is in terms of new jobs created, which is over 1,000, and which is in terms of additional revenue generated by these companies, which is going to be, if I'm not mistaken, off the top of my head, in the neighborhood of about 400 to 500 million rupees already. And remember, these have just been rolled out over the last year and 6 months. So inshallah, we look forward to great success.
Wonderful. But you sort of again, what you said to me is sort of, what you explained raises another thought in my mind.
Yeah.
We have built 200 universities around the country. We are short of faculty. I keep telling people we have built 200 buildings around the country, but we have no universities, right?
Yes,
because quite frankly, universities are centers of learning, and here kids, I'm disappointed. I don't know what we are getting. So why don't we crowdsource knowledge, just like you're crowdsourcing innovation? Why don't we try and use this process to create knowledge instead of using the 19th century method of lecture and student? Why don't we incubate knowledge just like you're doing? Would it be harmful if we set up, instead of a classroom, if we set up incubators in these universities and said, okay, guys, I want you to learn economics, right? And we are going to network all the students in Pakistan into this one big technology classroom. And we're going to get everybody, whoever we can find, Ishrat, Atawraman, whoever. Let them all come and talk to you, and let you, it's your responsibility to learn and innovate, and let's try and see what we can achieve together.
Right. So I think, let's think this through. First of all, I don't want to use the term incubator for it, because the universities already have incubators, and the specific function is to commercialize.
Fair enough. Fair enough. We can use some other term, right?
So some other term, let's take that forward. Now, many people, I know Dr. Pervez Lulboy blames Dr. Atar Rahman's expansion, for the poor quality of output and everything. On the other hand, I was just discussing this with Dr. Atar Rahman, and he was saying exactly what you're saying. He was saying that the universities, increased too fast, and the bottleneck should have been quality faculty. So this problem is out there. Now, he also built, I think it's called PERN, this network with all the great lectures and everything. So, but why hasn't it taken root? Because this is another problem I've studied closely. Because that's, the point is, we were given a target by the board to train 1 million people in intermediary and basic digital skills. Not in advanced, not in liberal arts, and not in sciences, but with this limited focus of intermediary and basic digital skills. Now, so we talked to 40, we talked to Coursera, a six-member team of Coursera, including the COO, a very fine lady who used to be in a venture capital firm before. You name it, edX, we brainstormed with all of them. There's an organization called Silani, a guy called Zafrullah Khan, who used to teach in Intel. He does this synchronized training of 500 people at one time. We looked at that model. We looked at IBM's model, which is in universities in the United States. It's a two-semester kind of finishing schools, which really builds up skills in the senior year through blended learning, which is some content is online or television, and the other is given by the professor. We ourselves have funded a company called Knowledge Platform, which in a test run of 2000, which we did earlier, improved the science scores of ninth graders by 23% in board exams.
Great.
And the math scores. And now we've expanded it to 70,000 students and across science and math. So we've kind of dabbled with this, right? Now, here's the thing. After DigiSkills.pk, which is online with 200 online coaches, I hope to, if the new minister agrees, if we get funded, to launch a program called CodeSkills.pk, which we call kind of the highbrow cousin of DigiSkills. This would be high and advanced digital skills. This would be data science. This would be Python and R. It would not be purely online, because online completion rates are abysmal, number one. Number two, we need 90% of the instruction to be in Urdu. Because very few people log on to and finish Coursera or edX, they don't enjoy English. So to scale 90% in Urdu, it has to be blended, meaning some online content, some classroom instruction, or it can be synchronized. That is one live lecture with students across the country. So this is something I hope to brainstorm. Only in this way, can we take limited quality faculty or people like Nadeemul Haq or Ishrat Hussain or Atar Rahman and multiply them by 10, use them as a force multiplier? Otherwise, quality faculty is really the bottleneck in all this.
But my point is that if rather than wait for quality faculty, because it's, you know, harder and harder to get. And this model of sending people for PhDs, then returning. I mean, you know, when they return, they're really not at that level. Quality faculty means that you have to really go through the mill for about 20, 30 years before you mature. So rather than trying to always play this game of sending people for PhDs and waiting for them to mature, and they never mature because they get caught in the local politics, why don't we just use this technique and the technology and be innovative and just crowdsource learning? Just simply say, guys, you're here to learn and we are here to help you, and we'll use technology or whatever means. I'm not saying follow edX or Coursera or whatever. There are so many other. Let's be innovative. The key thing that I find Yusuf Sahib missing is that we never take the risk and say, let's be innovative. And I think we need to do that. The good thing about the European culture was they took their ships and they said, let's find out where America, whatever is. They were not even looking for America. They navigated the whole world. And I think it was a very innovative, risk-taking exercise. And once again, the government funded it, if you recall. It wasn't a private enterprise. The government funded it. And they got that done. So it's a huge issue. But there it is. So thank you, Yusuf Sahib. Can I quickly ask you, before you go, to give us your recommendation for what students, A, should be focusing on in terms of their education, learning, etc., because I think you have an innovative approach. So you should tell us what you recommend students should do to prepare for themselves for this world, the new world. And the second question is, what would you recommend as the most important book, video, movie, anything that has influenced you a lot that everybody should try and look at?
Okay, well, the world toward which we are headed, we use the term fourth industrial wave because a lot of life-changing innovations are bunched up. We know that artificial intelligence is now replacing a lot of repetitive tasks. Even here in Telenor, a lot of the HR department, customer service department has been downsized. I was talking to the CEO of a mining company about a smart helmet which saves miners' lives that one of our Quetta startups has produced. He says, it's all robots. We don't have any miners. Mm-hmm. So first of all, the future is for the people who are creative and who are empathetic, who can deal with people. Creative, empathetic, and critical problem solvers. To accomplish that, in our school system, we got to step back and not stifle curiosity. We got to step back and not be dry discipline focused. We could be kind of project focused. In other words, instead of teaching physics and geography and history separately, take up 1857 mutiny and look at the technology aspect and the geographical aspect and the historical and the sociological aspect and make it really fun and interesting. With augmented reality, virtual reality, by the way, we can make some of this stuff really interesting. There's a very interesting startup we're about to fund where two girls have done just that, and they just won an international prize out of Korea. So number one is that at the school level. And then we know that the world is heading toward more and more technology. So STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, math, together with creativity and art, these are important skills to have. So for youth, we would, one would recommend that in the earlier years. insofar as recommending something, I think that knowing yourself, is the first step in engaging with the world and accomplishing stuff. So in my mind, anything which helps you know great literature helps you know yourself. Ghalib's Shairi helps you know yourself. I enjoy, for example, I really enjoy Notes from the Underground, Dostoevsky. I enjoy Gustav Flaubert, Hermann Hesse, Thomas Mann, some of my favorite authors. I love some of the poetry of Ghalib. Whatever resonates with you. And after that, if you want to learn about modern-day startups, modern-day entrepreneurs, I think Peter Thiel, 0 to 1, is a great education in that. Peter Thiel is one of the co-founders of PayPal, along with Elon Musk. And Elon Musk, you all, I think, have heard about. He's the greatest entrepreneurial inventor of our age. But the unique thing about Peter Thiel and PayPal was that he groomed 7 founders, CEOs, who went on to form billion-dollar companies, like Jawbone, like Tesla, like LinkedIn. Yes. So I think if there's one book,
Netflix.
Article,
mm. Mm.
Netflix, yeah, it's 0 to 1. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. 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 Great, Yusuf Saab, this has been a wonderful discussion. Really enjoyed it. And I'm not going to leave you alone. We must have some more discussions because I think you have a lot to offer and people would, should really listen to you because you've given us some wonderful ideas and I hope that the government listens to you and makes a Tabdili Commission. That is the most important thing of the time.
Doctor, it's a really pleasure to speak with, an intellectual, a guy who thinks, and a guy who's led the government, and I really enjoyed myself. Thank you so much. I'm honored to be on this show with you.
Thank you.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem-ul-Haq hai. Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.